Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more.
Straight talk.
No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
February 4th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. I'm broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower, on this cold February morning. Talking Law Radio is a show which will entertain you, educate you, and include you in the conversation about the hottest legal issues of the day. Talkin' Law is an interactive show. We want to hear from you. You can email the show at talkinlaw@gmail.com. You can follow the show on facebook.com/talkinlaw. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HochHeiser. You can listen to all our prior shows on blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Last week's show was great. We had former United States Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. I highly recommend you check that out on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes. Former Attorney General Gonzalez has a very interesting story, rising from basically nothing and poverty to becoming the chief law enforcement officer in the United States and serving as White House counsel during one of the most historic moments in our nation's history on 9/11. Today's show, we have an equally great guest, Bernard Kerik. Bernard Kerik is well known as the former New York City Police Commissioner. Commissioner Kerik began his career serving in the United States Army from 1974 to 1977. He did a tour in Korea, I believe, as a military policeman. He also served as warden of the Passaic County Jail in New Jersey from 1984 to 1986. He worked in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, as Chief of Investigations for the Security Division of the King Faisal Specialist Hospital from 1982 to 1984. In January 1998, Kerik was appointed Commissioner of the New York City Department of Correction, which involved his running Rikers Island. In 2000, on August 21st, 2000, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani appointed Kerik the 40th New York City Police Commissioner. Kerik served until December 31st, 2001. Kerik joined the NYPD in 1986 and served as an undercover police officer, a detective in the Narcotics and Intelligence Divisions, and also served as Mayor Giuliani's driver and in his protective detail, I believe. In 2001, Kerik published a memoir, The Lost Son, A Life in Pursuit of Justice, a New York Times bestseller. In May 2003, during Operation Iraqi Freedom, Kerik was appointed by George W. Bush as the interim Minister of Interior of Iraq. In December of 2004, Kerik was nominated by President Bush to succeed Tom Ridge as the United States Secretary of Homeland Security, which began Commissioner Kerik's legal problems. He pled guilty to a couple of misdemeanors in the Bronx, and he ultimately pled guilty to felony charges in federal court in 2009 and did approximately 3 years in a Maryland federal penitentiary. Without further ado, I say good morning to Commissioner Bernard Kerik. Commissioner, are you with me?
Yes, sir, I am.
How are you doing today?
Not bad. Not bad.
Good, good. So I saw that there was an article in the paper yesterday that your attorneys have moved the court to try to end your post-release supervision early?
Yeah. This is a normal procedure that's done. You know, it's you have the right after 1 year to make this request to the federal court. The probation department has to endorse it, has to support it. And it's done quite often because the supervised release or probation, as it's called, has, you know, there's a bunch of hindrances with regard to you getting other work, being able to travel freely, you know, getting real work by having this sort of cloud hanging over your head. So we've made a request to the court. It's nothing out of the ordinary, and hopefully the court grants it.
And I know that recently you've been running the Carrick Group. And can you tell our listeners what the Carrick Group does?
Well, basically, this is a company I had prior to my incarceration. It's a consulting group that specifically focuses on crisis management and risk mitigation. I've advised and consulted to various heads of state around the world, mostly or many in the Middle East, and works on counterterrorism strategies and other things relating to terrorism crisis management and risk mitigation.
And have you been able to continue that work after your release from prison?
Well, I put the company back up, started the company about a year and a half ago, and we're doing some consulting now to one company, and that's about all that's happened. There are some other opportunities that I can pursue if this probation issue is relieved.
Well, I hope it is. And if people want more information about your company, they can go to www.thekerrickgroup.com. You can also follow former Commissioner Bernard Carrick on Twitter at Bernard Carrick. Commissioner, if you don't mind, let's go way back in your history because you really have a fascinating story. My understanding is that you really came from very humble beginnings. Can you describe for our listeners briefly where you were raised, your childhood, and how you were brought up?
Well, I was born right here in New Jersey in Newark, and I lived there till I was about 12, and we moved to Patterson. I don't know if you've seen the movie Lean on Me, the major motion picture with Morgan Freeman about Eastside High School in Patterson, which really wasn't a center for education at the time, but that's where I went to high school, ultimately went to high school and dropped out in my junior year. When I was a child, a small child, I was about 3 years old, I guess. I was abandoned by my mother. My mother was later murdered when I was about nine. She was beaten to death, had a horrific life. And I was sort of rescued by my father, who came out to Ohio where she had taken me and picked me up, brought me back to New Jersey. And after I dropped out of high school, I went into the military. And my career sort of took off from there. I joined the U.S. Army. I was a military police officer, both in Korea and in the United States, assigned to Fort Bragg. I did basic military police duties. I was a sentry dog handler in Korea. And at Fort Bragg, I was a physical hand-to-hand combat instructor at the JFK Center, which is the John F. Kennedy Young Conventional Warfare Center that trains our special operations personnel.
And my understanding is that you're a black belt in martial arts?
Yeah, I have a first-degree black belt in Goju Karate, which is a Japanese form of karate, and I have a fifth-degree black belt in Taekwondo. I've studied both here in the United States and in Korea.
That's unbelievable. And how did that training in martial arts help you throughout your career when you rose through the ranks from the Passaic County Sheriff's Office to the Corrections Department of New York City to the NYPD?
Well, I don't think it was as important in the middle point or the end of my career, but it was extremely important in the beginning. It was basically something that taught me respect and discipline and self-control and a number of other things that the martial arts does. Those are things that I think every child growing up, every kid should learn. And I started in the arts when I was about 13, 14 years old, I guess right around 13. I earned my first degree black belt at 16. So that by the time I was 16 years old, I was extremely disciplined. I had learned respect. I had learned self-control, a bunch of other stuff. And that all came from the arts. And that's what got me, really put me in a position where I wanted to move on. I worked for a moving company for about 18 months after I quit high school. And I came to the realization real quick that humping furniture is an extremely difficult job, and it's really not something I'd want to do for the rest of my life. A bunch of my friends from New Jersey were graduating high school, going on to college. A number of them became law enforcement officers. It's something I wanted to do, so I joined the Army, got my GED, was an MP, and then when I got out, my law enforcement career began.
Now, you became the warden in Passaic County, and from there you went overseas, and then ultimately you wound up running the Corrections Department. Tell us a little bit about your experience running the New York City Department of Corrections.
As you know, as your listeners may know, Rikers Island is one of the, in New York City, Department of Correction really is one of the largest jails, jail systems in the United States. At the time, we averaged 150 stabbings and slashings per month. It had the highest violence rate of any facility in the nation. It was a completely mismanaged agency. We had about, I'd say, 133,000 annual admissions coming into the system yearly. And it was pretty much a mess. Our daily population, I think, at the time was about 22,400. Over the six-year period that I was in charge of the system, either as a first deputy commissioner, which is the number two in charge, or the commissioner, I reduced violence by 93%. The inmate-on-inmate violence reduced overtime spending by close to 40%, and created a number of other efficiencies where basically we took one of the worst jail systems in the nation and turned it into an international model for efficiency, accountability, and safety. And that safety wasn't only for the staff, but it was also for the inmates themselves. Safer living environments. They didn't have to worry about getting cut or stabbed or assaulted. We removed a bunch of the weapons inside the facilities. We held the inmates accountable for their actions when they, acted out or became violent. And we also held the officers accountable to do their job and make sure they were doing what they were supposed to do, nothing more and nothing less. And in 2000, Howard Safer was the police commissioner. In August of 2000, he resigned, retired. and the mayor tapped me at that time to become the 40th police commissioner of the city.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik. Commissioner, let's talk about 9/11, if you don't mind, because last week on our show, we had Alberto Gonzalez on the program, and on 9/11/2001, he was the White House counsel to George W. Bush, and he spoke to us about his experiences on 9/11. You were the police commissioner on 9/11, so can you take us through the beginning of your morning on 9/11 when you learned that a plane hit the North Tower?
When the first plane hit Tower 1, I was actually in my office in downtown Manhattan, which is about 5 blocks away, about a half a mile, I guess, from where the tower stood. I just finished exercising. I was getting ready to take a shower, and my chief of staff and one of my bodyguards came in and told me that a plane had just hit Tower 1. And I thought, as probably most other people did, that it was a small plane, one of the planes that fly up and down the Hudson River. I went out to the conference room, looked out the window, and I saw what everyone else saw as they watched their televisions, except I saw it pretty close up at that point. I called the mayor. I told him I would meet him at the New York City Emergency Management Center, which was in Tower 7, right across from Tower 1. And I proceeded down there with my staff. But when we got to Vesey and West Broadway, we couldn't turn into that block. There were people that were jumping from the tops of Tower 1, and they were landing in the courtyard between 2 and 1 and on Vesey, right in that courtyard outside of Vesey. So we couldn't turn into the block. There was also damage to Tower 7, structural damage, major damage from the eruption in Tower 1 itself. So I had somebody get a hold of the mayor's vehicle. He was going to meet me at West Broadway and Barclay Street. And I was calling for a temporary command bus to come down there and meet us on that corner when there was this enormous explosion above us. And I looked up, and it was the second plane coming through the north side of Tower 2. I didn't actually see the plane. I was on the north side of the building. I heard the engine, and then I heard the explosion. And when you see that big, enormous fireball on TV blow out Tower 7, me and many of my staff members were standing under it at the time. We got out of the way as the debris came down over the next minute or two, sort of regrouped because I didn't actually know what happened until I thought somebody was blowing up the buildings. I didn't know what happened until I heard the aviation pilots, the New York City helicopter pilots, yelling into the radios that a second airliner had struck Tower 2. And at that point, and only at that point, did I realize that we were under attack.
And Commissioner, what was the first opportunity you had to talk to Mayor Giuliani while this terrorist attack was unfolding on the World Trade Center?
The mayor got there within 2 or 3 minutes after the second plane hit Tower 2. The mayor arrived, and he pulled up. He met me at 75 Barclay Street. Right outside of 75 Barclay Street, there's a small Merrill Lynch office. My staff had taken over. We met there. We were looking at the damage. Was looking at the damage on the north side of the building. And then him, me, and a bunch of other staff members, we walked down to West Street, right across from the World Financial Center, to see the damage to the two buildings. And it was
so you
horrific.
You walked with the mayor down the street?
the mayor, and a bunch of more staff people.
Was there any conversation during that walk, and what was it?
Well, all of the conversation pertained basically to the response, what the response would be, what we would be doing, who was responding. There was a temporary command station directly across from Tower 1 over near the World Financial Center, and we walked down there. We met with all of the commanders on the scene. It was the first deputy commissioner of the fire department, Bill Feehan, Chief Gansey from the fire department, the chief of operations, Michael Judge, the chaplain for the fire department, was there. And there was a sergeant from the NYPD. His name was John Coughlin. He was in the emergency service unit. He was set up at that command post as well. We met with all these guys, spoke to them about what response levels there were, who was responding, what they anticipated we would be doing. And at that point, we left. The mayor and I left. I wanted to get him into a stationary command post. A number of his staff wanted him to go back to City Hall, to call the White House. I wanted him north and out of the danger zone. So we went back to where I initially met him, inside 75 Barclay, where he got on the phone with the White House. He was actually on the phone with the White House. The president, as you know, was in Florida, but the vice president was supposed to come to the phone to talk to the mayor. And 30 seconds, not even 30 seconds, 10 seconds, before Tower 2 began to implode, the mayor hung up the phone, looked at me, and he said, "This isn't good." He said, "They're evacuating the White House, and they think the Pentagon has just been hit." And it wasn't seconds later. I didn't even get my head around what he had just said when the building we were in began to shake. It felt like a freight train was coming through the side of the building. Tower 2 imploded and pretty much fell down on top of us where we were at.
Did you evacuate to the Brooklyn Bridge?
No, we were in that office for about 20 to 30 minutes. We could not get outside. We were sort of trapped in that office because we couldn't get out the doors we come in. All the debris and the rubble kind of devastated the streets on the outside. We had to get through a maze of tunnels, hallways in the basement of that building, and we actually came out on Church Street at the building 100 Church Street. We wound up in the lobby of that building, and then from there I took the mayor north on Hudson Street and went up to the fire station at, I think it's Hudson and Houston, and then from there we loaded him in the car and took him up to the police academy up in Midtown Manhattan.
Now, Commissioner, unfortunately, we don't have that much time left, and I want to get to certain things that I want to ask you. You rose to become the 40th police commissioner. You were commissioner during one of the most historic times in our nation's history. You were then tapped for a position as interior minister in Iraq, and then to become Homeland Security Secretary when you had the legal problems and resulted in you going to federal prison. My question is, after that unbelievable rise, what was it like when you first day you walked into that Cumberland, Maryland prison? Can you take us through that day a little bit? What was your experience like?
Yeah, it's listen. Any time that an American citizen that has never had a problem with the law is incarcerated, you cannot imagine what the deprivation of freedom is like. When your freedom is taken from you, it's unexplainable. It is demeaning, degrading, demoralizing. There is feelings of hopelessness and despair. It's the worst day, the worst time in your life. That's what it's like. And it's not just like that for me. It's like that for anyone, unless you're an institutionalized monster, unless you're somebody that has spent years on end in prison and you don't mind going back. And there are people out there like that. If you're not institutionalized, if you're somebody that has had a life, is somebody that, you know, had a law-abiding life, is somebody that is someone like me that worked for this country, dedicated their life in this country as I did, going into that circumstance is actually the worst day of your life.
And Commissioner, we're almost out of time, but how did your 3 years in prison change you as a person?
I think most importantly, what came out of me being away is understanding the realization that the criminal justice system, as it was founded, a few hundred years ago, it has changed substantially. We've evolved into a system that we feel it necessary to put people in prison for regulatory, administrative, civil issues. Look, people belong in prison. People belong to, people should be held accountable for their actions. But there are thousands upon thousands of people being held in prison today that didn't need to be there to pay for their mistakes. And that goes from a young, first-time, nonviolent drug offender, low-level drug offender. We give them 8 years, 10 years, 15 years. We tack on these years like it's just some sporadic number, to the commercial fisherman that caught too many fish, to a young man that sells a whale's tooth on eBay, to somebody that enhances their income on a mortgage application. There are thousands upon thousands of people in prison like that today that don't need to be there. And it's a waste of taxpayers' money. The collateral cost of their convictions dumbs down society, hurts society in many ways, economically, socially, morally. And it's something that I think has to change. We're in a position right now in this country where legislators are finally starting to understand this, and hopefully it's something that's going to change over the next few years, and I'm going to do everything in my power to make people understand what's out there, what it's like, what the realities are, and hopefully I can help bring change to the system that I think is broken.
Commissioner Kerrick, thank you for speaking out on these important issues and for joining us. I appreciate your time very much. For those who want to follow Bernard Kerrick, you can follow him on Twitter at Bernard Kerrick. You can look at his website at www.thekerrickgroup.com. Again, Commissioner Kerrick, thank you, and all the best. Now, before we get to Beth Karras, we are going to give the question of the day. The question of the day: how should we educate prosecutors about the reality of incarceration? After Beth Karras, I will give you the answer. But first, we talk to Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com.
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
morning, Beth.
Good morning, Dan. Well, that was an interesting interview. I sure would like to help Commissioner Carrick raise awareness about unnecessary incarceration. It was a good interview.
I'm gonna have to talk to Mark Goldman about making the show longer, because I could talk to Commissioner Carrick for another hour or two. He's so interesting. And I agree. I think what he's doing in speaking out for criminal justice reform is honorable. He doesn't have to do it, but he is doing it, and I give him credit for that. So, Beth, still in Maricopa County.
Oh, Dan, yes, I am. And the case is just sputtering along. The state is in a rebuttal presentation in the penalty phase of Jody Arias's retrial, just a penalty phase retrial. You know, Arizona is different from a lot of states that have the death penalty. If the jury's deadlocked on life or death, it defaults to the benefit of the defendant, and it's a life sentence. But that's not the case in Arizona. The prosecution gets two shots at the death penalty. If it's a deadlock the second time, then it's a life sentence. It's one of two life sentences the judge will impose within a month or two after that deadlock or life verdict, but she could still get death. You know, this case has been going on since October. That is the trial. So she was arrested in July 2008 for murder. She was convicted of murder in 2013. This is Jody Arias, who killed her ex-boyfriend. I can't believe that this penalty phase is going twice as long as anticipated. Now they're saying March. And I spoke with a top capital defense attorney in this city, Phoenix, Arizona, one of the best, who told me she had a penalty phase deliberation go for 3 weeks. That's just a deliberation. So, Lord, I don't know how much longer I'll be here, Dan, but I do want to come home to New York.
Well, I think you have to finish. I think you're in it to win it. And is it true that the penalty phase retrial may last longer than the actual trial lasted?
Well, you know, that depends on when they return the verdict. I can tell you that the guilt phase, you know, the trial was January 2nd, 2013, until the verdict was May 8th, and then the deadlock of life or death was on, I think, May 23rd. So it was basically nearly a full 5 months. This trial started October 21st, and it'll be about the same. Depending on how long the jury deliberates, it'll be about the same.
So, Beth, what happened? Was there court yesterday?
There was court, and the state has put on and still has on is a psychologist who's rebutting two psychologists who testified in the defense's mitigation last year and earlier this year. And there is quite a battle going on because of discovery violations. I don't know. I thought the defense made some good arguments to preclude this witness because she, you know, took notes on interviews from December about witnesses she was to testify about, you know, hearsay is admissible. And those notes weren't provided to the defense until last Friday, and they needed those notes to do an interview with her in anticipation of the cross-examination. The prosecutor said, oh, I didn't even know they existed until Friday. And he's like a 30-year veteran prosecutor. And this was a psychologist who's been in the case for years, and she interviewed these witnesses in December. And it's just hard to believe that this prosecutor didn't say, well, did you create any notes, type them up, give them to me, I need to turn them over. He didn't do that. And it's delaying things. And it's, you know, gamesmanship, according to the defense. And it just doesn't look good for that county attorney's office.
And so after this expert, where is the prosecution going after that? You know?
Well, they have a computer expert to put on just to rebut some allegations of there being pornography viewed on the victim's computer. Really not an issue that goes to life or death, but it is an issue the defense needs to develop for an appeal on the guilt phase, because the prosecution had argued all along that the victim, the ex-boyfriend, didn't have porn on his computer, especially child porn. And the allegation has been that he, you know, had an attraction to pornography, which is fine, but it's against his religion. He's a member of, he's Mormon, member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. And that perhaps there was, he was viewing some teen sex, and so that would be illegal. They just wanted kind of smear his character. But the prosecutor did stand up and say to the jury in summation in the guilt phase, there was no porn on the computer. And there was. So, and even the state is conceding there was, and the issue is how did it get there and can you prove it was the victim? But anyway, this is being litigated in this penalty phase to make a record for the appeal is what I see. I don't really think it goes to life or death.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio. I'm speaking to Beth Karas of KarasOnCrime.com about the Jody Arias death penalty retrial ongoing in Maricopa County, Arizona. Beth, my recollection is that the prosecution had put on a bishop as a witness, I believe, and he was cross-examined pretty aggressively by the defense. And I was wondering, what was your assessment of how the jurors reacted to that aggressive cross-examination of a member of the clergy?
You know, it's really hard to read jurors when I'm trying to see what's going on with them. Obviously, yeah, we don't know what's going on in their heads till it's over and they talk to us. But they're allowed to take notes. And when they're scribbling notes, you know, sometimes body language, you know, you can conclude or at least speculate on a few things. I don't really see much from this jury. I don't really – they're pretty stoic, but they do take a lot of notes. They had a number of questions for the bishop, but they were not that that probing. And the bishop was called to rebut an affidavit. Affidavits are admissible. You know, not the prosecution couldn't cross-examine allegations in an affidavit. So basically, he called the bishop to rebut some of these allegations in an affidavit. And this all way predates the victim and the defendant even knowing each other. It just goes into the victim and whether or not he had a proclivity to view porn. And this was from when he lived for a time in the bishop's home when he was much younger in the year 2000. So this aggressiveness with the bishop wasn't necessary. I mean, I don't know what the jury was thinking, but this bishop seemed to be totally forthright. He was, you know, the man of the cloth, and he just, you know, it seemed unnecessary. But the bishop didn't get rattled. However, he had some inconsistent statements, so the defense made some points, but they didn't need to do it in a nasty way.
Now, shifting gears a little bit, Beth, have you been following the Suge Knight, this rap mogul who's having some legal problems? I believe he's charged with murder for running over a former friend of his.
Yes, I'm following what we know, which isn't a whole lot yet. You know, but I've looked at the complaint, and he's charged with murder and attempted murder, and then leaving the scene after causing death, causing serious injury. And it's interesting because in California, when you get charged with murder, and it's not a degree. Later, things will flesh out, and you know, the jury may decide whether it's first or second degree. Sometimes murder goes to the jury, and then they're straight murder. And here he's charged with malice murder, which can be first or second degree, depending on express or implied malice. These are not concepts we use in New York, but he is saying that running over the guy he killed was an accident. So he doesn't seem at this point to be alleging self-defense, right? You know, self-defense is an intentional act, right? He's saying, I hit him by accident. We don't know what the eyewitnesses say. However, when it comes to the attempted murder charge, he's charged with attempted first degree. The actual language of first degree, willful, premeditated, with deliberation, is in the complaint. So, you know, they're saying, I guess, that the attempted murder was intentional, and leaving open a little wiggle room there that, you know, the murder could possibly be accident. I don't know if he's going to use two defenses. One was an accident, one was self-defense. I'm not sure, but we'll, you know, it's interesting to lawyers. I don't know how interesting it is to the lay public to sort of parse it out and figure out, you know, where the defense is going, but we'll see.
Well, and I think there was some news yesterday. I mean, I was certainly interested, and I'm guilty of being a lawyer, but I think there was a judge who recused himself, and there was a change in lawyers for Suge Knight.
Oh, you know what? Because I was in court all day, I didn't see the change in lawyers, and I know he was taken to the hospital because of panic or anxiety or something. I didn't see the change in lawyers, so I apologize for that. I got to get on top of that. I was actually reaching out to California lawyers, but all my friends there were former DAs, the ones I was reaching out to just on the law to make sure I understood the law, but I hadn't reached out to Suge's side yet. But I've been in court, you know, for Jody Arias all day.
Oh, you are excused and forgiven. And do we know if Suge Knight's still in the hospital?
No, I checked, and I didn't see any of the latest news about whether or not he's still in the hospital. I wouldn't be surprised if he was if he wasn't still in the hospital, if it was simply a panic attack, but I have no idea the condition of his heart. This is a man who's had a lot of trouble. He's been in prison before, and you know his bail has been revoked, so he's in the hospital incarcerated, and it's been revoked for three reasons. He's a flight risk. He qualifies under the three strikes law, and there's an allegation of witness intimidation.
Wow. Well, there's a lot to chew on in that case, and we'll keep our eye on it. Beth Karras, thanks so much, as always, for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Stay warm.
Okay, Beth, thanks a lot. Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com. Go check out her website for all the latest Jodi Arias penalty trial news. And now it is time for the Talkin' Law question of the day to be answered. Our question of the day is, how should we educate prosecutors about the reality of incarceration? Now, this is a very difficult question to answer because what happens is, and I know this because I was an assistant district attorney in the Bronx, fresh out of law school, you come out of law school, you're 25 or 26 years old, you don't know anything about prison, and all of a sudden you have this enormous power to put people in prison and to decide how much prison time somebody should do for a particular offense. And it's very difficult for a young, inexperienced prosecutor, even for an experienced prosecutor, to make these determinations about what type of plea offer is appropriate in a given case. So here's my answer. I would say have every new prosecutor go through the arrest process. Have them arrested, bring them to the precinct, bring them to central booking, let them be photographed and fingerprinted and searched, let them stay in a jail overnight, let them eat bologna sandwiches in the tombs, in the jail, let them smell the urine and the body odor of the other inmates. And I think if that was done, then prosecutors would really understand the value of a jail sentence that sometimes are just meted out seemingly capriciously and without really understanding what it means to spend a day in prison. You heard our guest, Bernard Kerik, who did 3 years in a federal penitentiary, and I believe he said that it was demeaning, humiliating, and really demoralizing to be to have your liberty taken away. And I think that sometimes in our criminal justice system, we lose sight of that. And I also want to commend former Commissioner Kerik for speaking out about nonviolent offenders, too many of whom are being incarcerated when they could be diverted to treatment programs and other non-prison sentences, because it is a waste of money for taxpayers. It does nothing to rehabilitate our nonviolent offenders and costs our society greatly in that these people who wind up with criminal convictions and spend time in prison cannot get jobs for the rest of their lives often, and it's just a tremendous drain on our society's resources and human capital. I want to thank Bernard Kerik, former police commissioner of the city of New York. I want to thank Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com. I want to thank my producer, Mark Goldman. I want to urge everybody to listen to our prior podcasts on blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. Please like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, H-O-C-H-H-E-I-S-E-R. Check out my law firm website at hochheiser.com. I wish everybody a good rest of the week, peace and justice. Next week, Wednesday, 9:30 a.m., we will have another great show, another great guest. Take care.